This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Puns can come in many shapes and sizes. You know, too often we encounter this self-serving wordplay that dead-ends the conversation. But today we're going to celebrate the highest form of no-grown homophones. The Great Durham Pun Championship tonight, Motoco Music Hall, the Regulator Bookshop's yearly wordsmithing tournament benefits the Durham Literacy Center, and it's already sold out. But we're going to get some linguistic relief during these dire times with the 2019 champion, Matt Moraine, joins us. Matt, welcome to the State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here.
Good to have you. Also with us, the competition's judge, Professor Emeritus in the Practice of Rhetoric at Duke University, George Gopin. Welcome back, George.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Frank.
Tell us a little bit about, give us an update now and talk about this contest, how it works.
We're in our ninth year. Astonishing. We sell out 20 minutes after the tickets go on sale. Most of the people have to stand all the way through the 2.5 hour evening.
How do they stand it?
Concrete floor, shoulder to shoulder.
You asked for this. You know you did. Well, let me.
I was a sitting duck for that.
Let's get the winner on here, Matt. I know there's lots of different kinds of puns. Maybe, and we hadn't really thought about this, but the sort of levels of puns, and you've thought about it. Tell us about how this thing works.
Yeah. So I think you can get into sort of the mapping the topology of language play, and you can look at dad jokes and whether a dad joke and a pun have things in common. And as you're sort of talking before, puns that kind of dead-end the conversation as opposed to puns that sort of you create in that moment, that discovery, and you go, ooh, this has never existed in the world. Let's do something with it.
Exactly.
It's the dog who catches the car and then doesn't know what to do. So I think the ones that are for delight are certainly in that. The ones that are for completely self-serving purposes are ones I do with my best friend Jeff frequently, of just leading him down a 20-minute angle in our threads and then paying that off, and then him, you know, threatening my life in various ways.
Now, you're talking about just setting up the pun? In other
yes.
words, you spend about 3 or 4 paragraphs just setting up the pun.
And sometimes you back into a pun accidentally, and then you go, ooh, what can I do with this? How do I find, where can I go? Like reincarnation instant breakfast. And then you try and you go, this
That's
isn't
right.
a thing, but
That's
I
right.
have to figure out how to make it a thing so I can share that with the world.
Oh, dear. What would you do with dictators? So let's move on, because what I want to do here is talk a little bit about, you consider this to some extent, you've been doing this a long time, a kind of a pathology in your case, right?
Yeah, I think if you've sort of been doing it, I'm the youngest of 4 in a very wordy, nerdy family, come from a long line of newspaper folks. Mm. And as the youngest of 4, you're trying to outdo your siblings. You're trying to be the one at the dinner table that has that delightful one. And so I think you train your synapses for 35 years to just word associate.
Right.
It's a compulsion at this point.
Yeah.
I don't choose it. It's just sort of the whether I let them out to play.
Yeah. Well, George, talk a little bit about this. What do you think distinguishes the admirable pun from the grown? Because I think sometimes people simply groan because it's a pun and they don't recognize the beauty in that moment, that creation.
I think that's half of the reasons for the groan, and the other half are people who do not want to be manipulated by the other person in the way the mind will work, and not seeing it coming and being surprised and not being uncomfortable with being surprised. So it's easy to just bop it on the head by calling it the lowest form of humor.
Yeah.
But actually the associative ability to hear or see other possibilities for this syllable or 2 syllables or 3 syllables you just heard as a word is a creative task. And it should be considered at the highest form of literature. And it is in one case that I can think of, a guy named James Joyce, who is so punish that you can't make your way to the end of the page without falling off your horse as you're trying to ride.
That makes it a punishment.
That's right.
Lob and point. Mm-hmm. Well, not to mention a guy named Shakespeare, whose body of work would be significantly shorter if we extracted all the puns. And we may not have even found them all yet.
I've actually made my way to television on Shakespeare's puns, because in my Shakespeare courses, I used to teach that, especially in the comedies, in the tragedies somewhat, two people were vying with each other in a conversation. The smarter of the two could take something in the last line of the other person's speech and take a word and twist it and knock him on the head with it. And one day I walk into my Shakespeare class and a student says, "Professor Copen, you were on Frasier last night." One of the writers for Frasier was a student of mine way back. And she learned this, and the two brothers in Frasier went to a bar vying with each other. One took the last line of the other and hit him over the head with it by making some kind of pun move on it. Mm. And the other brother said, "You must be a George S. Copen." She cut my middle initial wrong, but nobody in the country knew what that meant.
Right. What a great moment. Well, the other thing about it, too, I think is it's ingenious. And in a way, it also speaks to the ambiguity of language, which is its genius. I mean, language would be impossible without double meaning. We couldn't do it. You couldn't get 8 steps in language if words only meant one thing, or if they didn't have homophones that could take you another direction. Don't you think, Ben?
Yeah, I think it's recognizing the limits and saying, "That's nice. I don't care. I'm going to go do this and sort of create new rules, create new languages." And talking before about people who say, "You can't say that. That's a made up word." And then taking a beat and going, "How do you think we got words in the first place?"
That's right. Unlike the words that fell from the heavens like a
right,
jungle.
Yeah.
Wait, they're all symbols. That's the other thing. And so I almost think that there is a kind of a spiritual quality to this, that they can lead you into other realms. It's not just accidental, not just some kind of a fluke of spelling that can take us into these realms. There's ways in which this serendipity can really draw you into new insights.
And English is particularly rich where this is concerned, because English is a combination of two branches of the linguistic tree. Starts off with the Anglo-Saxons coming over with the Germanic language. They're around for a few hundred years, and then they get conquered by the Normans, who come with their French language. So we have this combination of the French and the German influence, and that's why English is so difficult, because the French and the Germans have never gotten along well together.
Well, and the rules tend to be all over the place, right?
All over the place, and the spellings and the pronunciations.
So do you, Matt, do you train? Because you said you were training at the table growing up, obviously.
But. Right. I don't have a workout regimen. I don't have a Rocky movie, but for puns, would be just the saddest thing you could see. Just people doing reps and saying, "Throw another category at me." But it's less that and more just kind of a thing that's always happening. I think Molly talked about that, one of the other competitors a couple years ago, that she's always thinking of them. Right. It never stops. I sort of think of it like Jupiter's Great Red Spot, this storm that's been burning for hundreds of years, and they just see it there. And so it's that.
Yeah.
My girlfriend will tell me she can tell when I have one that I'm really excited about, because my face will kind of shine a little bit and my smile will kind of get a halfway. And then she'll say, "Go ahead. Go for it. Get it out. I know."
Because it's not just words. It's whole phrases that you can flip around. What are some of the, now I'm putting you on the spot now, but some that really like delighted you in their ingenuity?
Yeah, I think I have a running thread on Twitter, on my Twitter feed, of ones I think of in the moment and go, "I have nothing to do with this. I just want to have proof that it existed." So it's things like Sylvester Stallone, the Icelandic Symphony Bjorkestra, Reincarnations at Breakfast, as I said before. Yeah. And if I was a person who is poor in spice, I might be a jalapeno popper. Or those kinds of ones where, and there's really nothing to do with it. Like a friend will just say, "Okay, acknowledge you did that." But the first trick I taught my dog when I got him 11 years ago was to high five in case people weren't around to high five after a joke, or in case people stopped and both scenarios have come true.
Not only that, but I'm guessing by now your dog can see the same face that your girlfriend
I'm
does.
I'm sure he can.
And knows either to run away.
Goes to the other part of the couch, just sighs at me and goes, I wish we had a different dad.
There are there are homophones, too. There are ways in which even the sound of a phrase by sort of manipulating the phrase can give you, and the cadence as well.
Right.
Is pretty important.
And you have that Anglo-Saxon homophone, which is what I played in band in high school, which was that...
the homophone.
Yep. How has this changed this contest in terms of the reception, George, or the level of the competition?
Level of the competition has increasingly improved over all 9 years. Each year, faster, sharper, almost aggressive. I mean, I wouldn't want to play Matt in one of these. He's just fabulous. Yeah. I guess if I pointed to one indication of the improvement, it would be the speed with which the next pun comes. We have a timer who's keeping track of how long it takes each person to come up with the pun after it becomes their term. Because if both contestants get 10 good puns, we stop the match, and the timer adds up the amount of time that each person took for their 10 puns, and the lower time wins.
Wow. Has that timer been with you a long time? I'm just trying to figure out if they're an old timer.
Mm-hmm. Or not. Well, he got him secondhand. So it wasn't, yeah.
That's where I have to stop. I'm out. You win. You win.
I admire the heck out of George and of the timers. I would argue that it is, by an order of magnitude, easier to just come up with dumb language things you hear in your head than it is. George has to be knowledgeable on such a wide range of topics to decide whether or not that's a valid pun or a not valid pun. And you will hear the audience behind him if it takes a second. It's sort of thing, well, I don't know a whole lot about The Simpsons in the early 90s, but maybe there is. And someone from the audience will just go, it's a Homer joke, or just like shout out things to him. And it's sort of that.
The audience plays an increasing role, too. That's another indication of the audience. They're recidivists as well. I mean, they come in and make sure I don't make any mistake. It's the hardest night's work of the year for me.
Do you think so? Speaking about Twitter and the fact that you're getting younger audiences, do you think social media has any effect on this one way or another? The ability of people to pun, our receptiveness to it.
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think we used to have sort of a shared cultural experience, and now we're so fractured and for a lot of good reasons for that. But I think any event that happens, like the Iowa caucuses last night, where there was a technical snafu, if you're on Twitter, you see people just joking and dunking on them. You see hashtags popping up that are fun little puns, and you see sort of a way of really being able to participate in that without, being across the table for someone or making your dog run away. I think there's that chance to be able to play around with that, and it's low stakes, and you do enough low stakes practice and you sort of get yourself ready.
And other people rise to the occasion. So people who may not have thought about, sort of playing along are playing along. And we talked about the power of this stuff. I mean, George, really, all poetry is a form of punning, right? I mean, the idea that you will have multiple meanings in a phrase or a turn of a phrase or a word, there would be no poetry if it weren't for the ability for words to be ambiguous.
The Greek word for this is paranomasia, which is a playing with words of all kinds. So pun is just one subcategory of paranomasia. But yes, the idea of having a word allow your mind to go in two directions at the same time, whether you are conscious of it or not, is what's really rich. With poetry, I taught poetry for 45 years, I would occasionally take a great line and change one word so that the line became poverty-stricken. And discussed, what did that other word give to all these other words in this line that this word doesn't? This word's pretty empty where the others are concerned, and that was multifariously functioning.
And I think you see here the sort of cerebral approach that George brings to this. All I could think was, when you posed that question, was Tony Stanza. There's nothing to do with that. There's the actor Tony Danza, and a stanza's part of that. And it's just sort of like if someone hands you an ice cream cone without the cone, and you have your hands outstretched, you're like, what am I supposed to... I don't want this.
This is not making reference to anything. But you're doing that too. So just that kind of thing.
Yeah, like it's just
Tony Stanza. Mm-hmm. And then, but you do store this and wait for the moment that you can probably do the Tony Stanza.
No, I think the Italians call it sprezzatura, which is this sort of feigned spontaneity. And I think that's icky to me. Like that idea of like, I thought of this 2 days ago and I've been holding on to it. And some of that too is just, it's a clearinghouse in my brain. I need to get them out. Right. I should have a strict one in, one out policy, but it gets crowded in there if I try and hold them for too long. I just kind of get them out.
I've got to respond to that because for me, sprezzatura is one of the great words and one of the great things. For me, I understand it as the ability to do something extraordinarily difficult and make it look extraordinarily easy.
Like,
like a great golfer is sinking a 60-foot putt, which goes up the hill and down the hill and around, and it just drops in, and they say, aha.
If you chugged a whole 2 liter of soda, if it's the right one, it might be Sprite-satura, which is just, it's not.
Do you find yourself having to check yourself and say, no, not now. No, Matt, no.
Yes, all the time. There's definitely the feeling you get when, like, I'm a lot if I don't sort of filter that. So the idea of not wanting to inflict that pain on other people, it's a really kind of a delicate dance of sort of reading the room and going, do people really want to hear this right now?
So it's when it's genius and they do, but it might be like so totally inappropriate.
Yeah.
That's the killer.
There's
and
that.
It's like dying in your mind and you think, I cannot give that the breath of life. And yet, oh my goodness, why do I have to keep
this
it to myself?
Great,
because it stops being about the pun.
Yeah.
And it's only about the punster.
Ah.
It's the punster saying, pay attention to me, everybody. No matter what you say, I can lead you away from where your mind was going and bring you back to me because of what I did to that one.
I'm Dickens, he's punster. That's a real old TV show. I got people rushing now. George Gopin is a professor emeritus of the practice of rhetoric at Duke University. George, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Glad to be here. Thank you, Frank.
Matt Morian, the winner of the 2019 Great Durham Pun Championship. Matt, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Frank. This is wonderful.
And unfortunately, it's sold out, but the benefit is for the Durham Literacy Center. It's going to be at Motorco. Regulator Bookshop puts it on. They all deserve your congratulations and support as well. You can find out more about our show at our website, stateofthings.org. It's a show that's produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hull of Mormon, and Katie Barron. Jenny Lawson is the technical director. Josie Taras is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.